Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Ghibli Attack, the podcast that dramatises the films of one of the world's greatest animation studios, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I'm hashtag finding my spirit.
So join us on our theatrical quest into the glorious world of Studio Ghibli. Jake, you're all hashtagged up.
Yes, I am. Well, I mean, this one has been brewing for a long, long time, and we're very glad it's happening. Slightly out of order, but in a way perfectly timed, because in today's podcast, you had the pleasure of talking to Tom Morton Smith, the writer of the My Neighbor Totoro stage show. And initially, this was something that we wanted to set up before the stage show started its run. And then we were thinking, well, not a lot of people are going to get to see this straight away, so maybe we should let the run happen and then put this out. But then, perfectly, it got announced that there's going to be another run of this show anyway. So loads of people might have had the chance to see it already and are now going to hear from the writer about adapting it. Or there are people that haven't had the chance and can hear this and get excited about going to watch it. Although, I think at the time of this coming out, tickets may have already completely sold out.
Well, yeah, it's back at Barbican later in the year and tickets have gone on public sales. So if you listen to this, try your arm. Hopefully there will be some available, maybe for your second, third, fourth, fifth time seeing the play. But yeah, I guess doing this interview now, in some ways, the pressure is off. I'm thinking back to our interview with Basil Twist, who was involved in the puppet design process for the production. There wasn't really much we could talk about because it was all shrouded in mystery. Whereas now, almost a year on, with a record-breaking, successful box office run at the Barbican, winning five What's on Stage awards, six Olivier awards. You know, it's safe to say people liked this show, so I guess Tom can relax a little bit and bask in that while talking about it.
Yeah, and it is quite funny seeing now the reveals on social media about the contents of the show, because when we were first talking about it, and as you said, even within the conversation with Basil Twist, everything was shrouded in mystery as to what this thing is actually going to look like. I think before it came out, we were thinking this is going to be more like a shadow play type thing where we're not really going to see anything and it's all going to be silhouettes, and the theatre of the mind will have a lot to impact with. But actually, there's a lot that happens on stage, and that's one of the incredible things about it, and that totally wowed us on the night, is how much you see. And Totoro does come to life in front of your eyes, and it's quite amazing. And if you look at the videos that are now available or being posted to promote this new run, some stuff is now being revealed, but some stuff isn't. And so if you haven't seen the show, you might see now how the soot sprites appear, which is one of the most ingenious elements of the show, where the soot sprites are kind of on the end of sticks, on the end of puppeteers' fingers. And all of those puppeteers are visible on stage. and appear and disappear in a really wonderful fashion. And so they're not trying to hide them whatsoever. And it totally works. And that's something that they're now showcasing. But key factors like big grey forest spirits with massive animatronic mouths do not appear in any materials yet, because that is something that you do want to kind of keep for the surprise on the night.
Yeah, I respect them so much for keeping that mystery alive, even years on into its second run. That's so exciting, isn't it? Well, we should hear from Tom, and what we'll hear about is how the project came to be, his relationship with Totoro, how you approach adapting such a beloved film to the stage, the little tweaks and changes you may make along the way, and then also what Miyazaki and Ghibli had to say about that process. Unfortunately, due to a calendar upset, it's just me on the call. But Jake, you already had your chat with Tom, didn't you?
I did, yeah. And so I just, sometimes you just got to keep a podcast for yourself. And sometimes a podcast is simply a chat on a train. And so it's very Ghibli, in fact.
I mean, incredibly Ghibli-ish, yeah. You harangued him on the tube.
Yeah. And so I happened to be sitting next to Tom on the tube. And so I got my own private podcast conversation with him all about the production. And so I felt there was no need for me to be here to spoil that conversation and repeat it. So I let Michael have this one.
We hear as well from Tom about his career so far, writing plays such as Oppenheimer, Ravens, also now developing screenplays. It's all very exciting stuff. I love that up until Totoro, he'd mostly been working in very serious, politically themed, physics themed theatre. And then he had the chance to embrace writing a stage play for a broad family audience. We get into that as well. So really, without further ado, we should listen to our interview with Tom Morton Smith.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tom, welcome to the podcast. It's been a long time coming. How's your last year been?
Yeah, it's it's been quite good. Totoro, getting Totoro finally on felt like a huge, you know, it was the sudden realization that actually it was happening, it was real, it wasn't a fever dream that I'd kind of made up. I think the nature of writing, of working on something, you know, it's a relatively solitary thing most of the time, and especially throughout the pandemic when everything was done via Zoom or via email, It really felt like I'd made it up. Like I was just having a hallucination that I was adapting My Neighbor Totoro for the stage. So to finally get it up there and open, that was pretty big. And for it to have been received as well as it was, and the fact that it's coming back, it's been quite a good year. Thanks.
No, it's been absolutely wonderful to see. We were very much part of that excitement to begin with. Obviously there's all of this smoke and mirrors about how it was going to be, staged, all of the surprises that are, still under wraps, still haven't really been shown in sort of promotional imagery and stuff. But then to see how well it did, and then how well it continues to do in terms of awards and acclaim, and then coming back. Yeah, we're so pleased for you and the team. For this success, I suppose let's go all the way back to the beginning, maybe not to Year Dot, but yeah. How did Totoro first come on your radar?
I first became aware of Studio Ghibli. I must have been at school, and I remember hearing about Princess Mononoke. And I think there was like a VHS tape that was kind of being passed around or something. So I remember it being on my radar. I don't think I saw it, but I remember kind of recognizing the name of Studio Ghibli when Spirited Away came into the cinema, and I went, "Oh, I've heard they make good stuff." And so Spirited Away was the first one, having been aware of talk of Mononoke. Kind of that was enough to get me to buy a ticket to see Spirited Away, and I think it was a pretty empty cinema when I saw it, but that blew me away. It's such a virtuosic, is that a word? Yeah, that'll do. You know what I mean? A film from Ghibli. It feels like Ghibli kind of firing on all cylinders and showing off everything they can do in one movie. And that made me kind of want to hunt out all the others. And, early 2000s, this was the time where you kind of still, you might get things on DVD, but you might have to hunt out things on VHS. And so I remember kind of tracking down a copy of Totoro, but not much until a few years until they started releasing more stuff in the cinema. So I saw Howl's and Arrietty and pretty much everything after that, When the Wind Rises. And then kind of, yeah, and just kind of being, they were, it felt like my own private thing, because no one else I knew was really interested or aware of it. Until the last couple of years, where it's all kind of, I guess since being on Netflix and it's just kind of become a bigger part of the public consciousness. All the films being shown on Film 4 all the time, it's great because it's kind of like, oh, there's a slight kind of hipster attitude of kind of, oh, I was there a bit earlier, but it's just delightful to kind of meet people who know what you're talking about when you say Pompoko. So
yeah. No, that's it's been really fun to see that happen in our lifetimes, in our adulthood at least. So when you said that was almost your private thing, was that sort of your taste in cinema as a young man, sort of animation or world cinema, or what was your sort of diet back then?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a bit of a movie buff, but I used to hang around with a bunch of guys at university who were really into they were really into horror movies, and horror was never really my kind of thing. But they showed me, I think, Tetsuo the Iron Man and Audition and Ichi the Killer and those sort of things, and Ringu obviously, and I kind of got me into Japanese cinema that way, but I would never say that those were my favorite Japanese movies. As I've kind of been working in theater, I kind of, you know, that's where I've been, that's kind of what I would say is my first passion, and cinema was always my hobby that I kind of obsessed over and found, you know, go on weird little deep dives into the back catalogues of directors and things. But it always felt like I didn't have many friends who were really into cinema in the way that I was, and so it always kind of felt a slightly solitary kind of interest.
It is a very true thing about that particular generation or that particular age group, where it was the more, it's the Asia extreme generation. That was for many of us our introduction to all sorts of Asian cinemas via horror. And then as we've grown up, we've maybe mellowed and discovered other filmmakers. I mean, none more different maybe than Totoro. And I guess that's where the love of film, love of theatre crosses over a little bit. So at what point did Totoro come on your radar within all that viewing? And what did you think of it when you first saw it?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it was post Spirited Away. I think I must have seen Mononoke after Spirited Away. I think that was the next one I saw. And I can't remember. Did I find it on VHS somewhere? It wouldn't have been on TV that early, I don't think. I remember. I don't remember the specifics of where I watched it, but I can certainly remember the atmosphere that it kind of threw up. Gentle and ambient it is. How it kind of it goes from the beautifully painted kind of landscapes and the beautiful music of Joe Hisaishi, and it just allows you to exist in that world for the duration, and that was something that that always stayed with me, and whenever I had an opportunity to see it, if they were showing it, when they showed it at like the BFI or something, it was kind of like, oh, I got to go and try and see that because I love seeing that on the big screen, because it's so immersive. And I think that's what, when the RSC were kind of asking me, was I interested in doing a family show at any point? I kind of went, I want to do My Neighbor Totoro because I know that theatre does atmosphere so well, and I know that it does character so well, and you know, and when you're sat in an auditorium and you're watching a play, and you just let the world of it kind of flow over you, it's the closest I've ever got to that in cinema, I think, is in Totoro. And so they kind of feel, it felt like, yeah, I know how this would look on stage. I wouldn't necessarily know how we could do the big creatures, if you do the cat bus and the Totoros themselves. But there's, I think there's a connection between the atmosphere that the film manages to create and the atmospheres that the best kind of theatre shows managed to create as well.
So is that, you know, talking even separately from Totoro, is that how plays are born in terms of the inspiration? Is it with a feeling necessarily rather than a character or a moment or a look or a line or dialogue?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, it's probably different, not only different from theatre maker to theatre maker, but it's probably different from on play to play for me as well. So my big play I did before Totoro was Oppenheimer, which was about the building the atomic bomb, and it was basically the RSC had invited me to pitch them the biggest thing I could think of because they wanted, you know, Shakespeare's famous for his epic history cycles and his epic battles, and you know, they wanted new writing to kind of rise to the challenge that is kind of set by Shakespeare. So I pitched them an 8-play play cycle in the history of physics in the 20th century. And they went, that's too big. Pick one. And I picked Oppenheimer, which is still a massive story, and it had a cast of 22 and it had music and it had dancing. And that all kind of came from me trying to understand, having an interest in physics that isn't an academic interest at all. It's just, that's cool, that's interesting. And then you find out the biographical stories and the anecdotal stories around how these discoveries are made, and you kind of go, that's something that's really interesting. And that helps me to understand how the world works a little better. With Totoro, it's not too dissimilar, because what I love about the film is that in the same sort of way, it's an exploration about kindness, about how people interact with each other, the characters. And yeah, it's, I don't know, I'm trying to draw a link between big, epic, Shakespearean kind of scale things and the beautiful slice of life emotions that Miyazaki deals with so well. And that you see throughout Japanese cinema, in certain strains of Japanese cinema, where the big thing is the character. And Totoro is often accused of kind of not having a huge amount of plot, and people, and that, and in that way, people were kind of saying, how do you make a stage play out of it if there isn't a huge amount of plot? But for the characters, these are the biggest things, the biggest feelings they could possibly be having. The idea that, you know, Mei is a 4-year-old or Satsuki is a 10-year-old coming to terms with the fact that their mum might die is the biggest epic feeling they could possibly have. And that's what draws me to anything, is finding a way to explore those epic feelings, even if they, in the large scheme of, you know, an infinite universe, they mean very little. Another play of mine called The Earthworks is about the Large Hadron Collider. It's that set, basically, it's a rom-com between two people, and they meet the night before. They turn on the Large Hadron Collider as a journalist and a scientist, and that's all about, you know, we're about to turn on the biggest machine mankind's ever made, but it's the small human interactions that are the most important things. And so in Totoro, you have these giant creatures, this giant fantasy, but the most important thing is the relationship between the two sisters, the relationship between the parents, and the relationship between the dad and the daughters, and the mum and the daughters. And, yeah, so it's all about the finding the big stuff in the small stuff, or the small stuff in the big stuff. It's, you know,
that is the magic that Miyazaki finds, really, in these magical lyrical moments that can be so magical, but also can be so everyday and change the way we look at the world around us. You mentioned there the feeling or the argument that Totoro has no plot. Certainly, if you were going to sit down with your Hollywood screenwriter rule books, you'd have to mould it into a different shape. But you then had to sit down with a blank page to start an adaptation. So how did that process work out? Because, it's still the same story, but how did you actually put pen to paper?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing, as a point of kind of adaptation, is that I remember the literary department at the RSC were chasing Ghibli to get hold of a copy of the original screenplay, and there isn't an original screenplay. There's Miyazaki's storyboards. So they managed to kind of send me, which have been published, and so they kind of send me a copy of that book, and all the dialogue is written, obviously, in Japanese, kind of in the margins of that. And then there's they sent me a literal translation of the Japanese, but there's also the subtitled version, and then there's also the dubbed version. So it never felt like I was always working from multiple sources to create the English language stage play, which was quite freeing. I feel like I've hit every moment, major moment in the film, and quite a lot of the dialogue is recognisable from the film, even if it's not exactly word for word the subtitled version or the literal translation or the dubbed version. But I think having the freedom to kind of expand out of that allowed me to remain more faithful to it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so some of those moments, I'm reflecting back on 6 months ago when we saw the production, they may just be little bits of dialogue here or there, or an exchange between, I think, of Kanta and his father have a very, very beautiful exchange at one point. How did you find these moments to flesh out, and how did you find that right balance between adding something for the stage versus honouring the original?
Yeah, well, I think the just taking a screenplay and putting it on stage is never gonna work, because they are two very different mediums. And what you're able to do and I found this since I've been working in film and TV as well, is that the sequences that you work on in film can be several scenes long to kind of do that you follow a shape of a sequence. On stage, a sequence tends to be a scene. A scene has to have its beginning, its middle, its end. The characters have to be changed when they leave the scene than how they were at the beginning. And so that meant looking at Totoro and tiny little moments, like the moment where Kanta is feeding his chickens and he sees in the distance Satsuki turn up with Mei, and Satsuki goes off to school and Mei stays with Granny, and that's the scene. It's like a couple of seconds long. But that moment was an opportunity for me. The way it's an important moment for to have in the film and for the story, but it's not enough of a moment to directly translate onto stage. So I had to expand that out into a bit of a scene, and it's now the scene where Kanta is having a conversation with his chickens is probably my favourite scene in the play now, because you've got these fantastic kind of bobble-headed chicken puppets that are kind of having a conversation with Kanta. Kanta was really interesting to adapt, because he is an incredibly inarticulate person, and he's inarticulate in front of Satsuki for one reason, and he's inarticulate in front of the adults for other reasons. But on stage, you can't just have a character be utterly inarticulate, because it. You could probably try, but I didn't want to have him be completely inarticulate. I wanted to kind of burrow a bit deeper into him. So to have him kind of be fully himself in a scene where he's talking to chickens, where he could be as articulate as he wanted to be, it was nice to be able to kind of have that moment that exists in the stage version and not the film.
Mm. And you mentioned the puppetry there. Of course, there's so many moving parts within this production, you know, as well as the music and the puppetry. How much were you aware of that? How much of that is in the script, I suppose, or how much is that developing alongside it or informing? Because of course, or is it all in your head and you just get surprised as it all goes along the process?
I mean, the first version of the script that I wrote, where I was just concentrating on turning the film as it exists into something we can work on in a Word document or on paper. When it got to the big sequences, this is before we had Basil Twist, the puppet designer, on board. I think it was before we even had Phelan, the director, on board. So it was kind of, I don't know how we're going to do this. So I just write, a cat bus turns up. My stage directions are essentially just me describing the action of the film. And it's kind of, I don't know how we do this. Totoro walks on. He's a giant kind of furry forest spirit. A cat bus turns up. Its eyes are headlights. It's got rats for brake lights. And you know, it's in many ways, as a writer, how they were to achieve those stage directions is not my concern. And I shouldn't get bogged down with practicalities. I was always kind of expecting someone to come back to me and say, right, what you've written here just describes what happens in the film. That's not possible. So rewrite it into something that is possible. But Phelan, Phelan McDermott, the director, he comes from a background of improvisation, and the big rule in improvisation is saying yes and running with it. So it was never, no, we can't do that. It's, yes, we can do that. How do we do that? And that spirit of kind of embracing every ridiculous kind of fantastical moment of the film and saying, let's find a way to do it rather than see it as a problem. It made my life a lot easier because I didn't have to go back and change all the stage direction.
And as an audience member, though, that the fact you can almost feel that sense of let's try it, let's do it, let's go for it. That sparkle is within the production. So does that mean, I suppose, that your job as a writer then isn't just at the beginning, it goes all the way through almost to opening night, or do you check out earlier on?
I trained as an actor originally, and I really enjoy being in rehearsal rooms, and I enjoy being in tech rehearsals, which is a slightly weird thing to admit to because they are deathly boring. But I just like seeing the script that I worked on, that I put so much energy kind of coming alive and seeing all these incredibly talented, skillful creatives and technical people bringing that world to life is, you know, really exciting to me. So I like to be there as much as the director will tolerate. And with Phelan, who works in a very collaborative way, if I could be there, he wanted me there, which was great. And it meant that when we were having conversations about making certain moments work, I could bring an opinion to it on narrative and what tracks in terms of story that perhaps the designers, you know, who are suggesting things don't have, and vice versa. So it was all kind of, everyone was in the room at all times and everyone was allowed an opinion on everything. Everyone has their specialities, but no one's opinion was discounted. And that meant there were, because we were talking about, I think the Soot Sprites is a good example. So we had these fantastic Soot Sprites that they were playing around with, and they're like, they're not pom-poms, they're fluffier than that. They're like, they're made of like feathers, I think. And they're all on these like exaggerated Freddy Krueger gloves. All the different kind of carbon fiber rods they're made out of, that the Soot Sprites are kind of attached to the end of, that come out of these gloves. They're all slightly different thicknesses, and some of them are slightly different materials. It was a really subtle thing that meant that they all move, even though they're coming from the same hands, they all move slightly differently, just because the materials are slightly different on each one. But everyone was kind of going, this is great. And they move really well. These small, tiny little pom-poms. But you don't kind of get the, in the film, sometimes they have eyes. And we were kind of going, well, can we just put googly eyes on them? Would that look right? And we tried that, and that didn't look right either. And through discussion, we have, you know, it kind of came out, well, let's have someone kind of, when they're all kind of coalescing in a cloud at the middle of the stage, let's have someone come on with the eyes and kind of have them poke out. And that moment kind of came out of sort of group discussion. And I don't think you'd be able to kind of track whose idea it was. And that, you know, it's that sort of thing that kind of it felt like everyone had a hand in that moment. And there are plenty of examples throughout that did,
Yeah, and I think that sense of collaboration within the group was so evident across all the social media, everyone talking and sharing their stories. It's been really wonderful to see. Of course, there's one big opinion we've not talked about yet, or at least what the extent of it is. What relationship did you have with Miyazaki and Ghibli in the process of writing the scripts? Of course, you had all the various versions to work from, but did you meet the man? Did you talk to the man?
Yeah, so quite early. I mean, there was more kind of going to Japan planned that never happened because of COVID and the pandemic. But we were invited over to Tokyo in 2018. That's me, the RSC's literary manager, and the RSC's lead producer on it at the time. We went and we met everyone at Nippon TV and kind of sorted out a whole load of legal stuff. We were taken to what is now the Studio Ghibli theme park, and where they have had the Kusakabe house, and we were allowed to kind of so we visited that and to kind of get a real sense of the world of it. And then we were given a tour of Studio Ghibli's premises, and then they were working on Earwig and the Witch when we were there, we met with Toshio Suzuki. He let me hold the Oscar for Spirited Away, which was propping up a bookshelf in his office, which is great. We had meetings with Joe Hisaishi. And when we were there at Ghibli, we weren't sure whether Miyazaki was going to join us. And we were all sat in this kind of conference room, and the door opens and then he just comes in and sits down. He was intrigued, I think, by the idea of adapting it for the stage. But I think he's got a peculiar relationship with Totoro now, I think, because it was always, he said that Totoro was always the kind of thing that he doodled in the kind of margins of his school books. And to see it go from that to the huge, great merchandise behemoth that it is, that financially carried them kind of through difficult times in the 90s, I think. And I think he's kind of, it's been replicated and put on so many lunchboxes that I don't know what his relationship to the character is anymore, but it's certainly different than to what it was when he first imagined it. The key things that he wanted me to take away was that if it's going to be a play, it needs to be its own thing. It shouldn't just be a facsimile of the film, and that's great. And he was quite open to me kind of bringing elements of myself to it. And B, he wanted, you know, Totoro to be a creature of the forest, in that it's not just a fluffy man in a suit, that it that he feels quite dangerous, that he could be a bit smelly, that his fur could be matted rather than kind of pristine, and that there should be a sense of excitement and danger around the creatures in the woods. And I hope that we kind of managed to kind of stay true to that idea that he gave us.
And now that it's been on stage and received well, how have the Japanese partners responded to that? Were they happy with what they saw?
Yeah, I mean they're delighted. We haven't, you know, Miyazaki didn't come over to see it because he's a very busy busy man, obviously, working on his new film. But all the executives from Ghibli came, and they were very pleased. And there were still some fine tweaks during the tech rehearsals and preview periods about getting the shape of Totoro's eyes just right. They're very particular about every tiny little detail around that. I think everyone's just delighted with how it's kind of how it's done.
So did you receive much feedback as you were writing the scripts? Of course, things like the shape of Totoro's eyes is like a very specific detail, but anything on the sort of plot or writing side?
Yeah, we there were certain lines that some of the producers kind of felt that, no, we definitely need to have. There was a long conversation around, you're the flower shop now, Daddy. Which I'd kind of taken out into a whole scene, but didn't actually say that line. And they said, you need to say the line. And I went, oh, okay, I've got a scene where they're playing flower shop. Is that not enough? And said, no, they need to say the line. Okay, I'll just put it back in the beginning. So there were kind of some very specific things like that. I think there were some elements where I expanded out from the film about... with Granny's character, by kind of drawing in, I was really worried about the scene. It's a very grown up scene in a family show, where May questions Granny about whether she has a sister, and Granny says, "I did," and May says, "Did she die?" And that was me feeling that for the stage play to work, for the second half to really kind of emotionally hit home, you needed to bring in the idea of death earlier. You needed to bring in the idea of particularly sisters could die, you know, earlier. And to do that through Granny, that felt like something that was very important to me in order to make the stage version work, which is something that isn't in the film at all. There was a little bit of rumbling from some producers about, oh, God, do we want to be... This doesn't sound like the happy, jolly, fluffy kid show we were hoping for. The more we worked on it, the more they read what I'd written, and when they kind of saw it up in practice, that it absolutely kind of feels right and feels within the world of the... of the story to kind of just not, it doesn't delve into too much darkness, but it does touch on it. And it's, I think that's important in order to kind of prepare the audience for what happens in the second half.
Yeah, it teases out a theme or plants a seed to grow later in the play. Of course, how do you as a writer, what goes through your head as you're pitching a script for a play for a family audience, for a younger audience, and presuming that the Large Hadron Collider physics type plays are for more grown-up audiences.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah.
What thoughts are in your head when you're writing for a mixed audience like that?
I think this is the first family show I've written. I didn't treat it as any different to anything else, to be honest. It's kind of... I wouldn't let myself swear in it and it's not going to suddenly get into anything too gritty. But you know, what you're doing when you're adapting is you want to capture the essence of something, even if the lines are completely different. And the essence of Totoro, what it does so well as a film, and what I hope that we've managed to do with the stage version, is tell tell a story that works on multiple different levels. If you're a young child, if you're May's age and you kind of come and see it, then it's a fantastical adventure with some big, furry forest friends. If you're Satsuki's age, then or similar, then it's a coming of age story about a girl learning responsibility for the first time. If you're an adult, it works because you see it through the parents' eyes, and it's about children growing up and wanting to protect the idea of childhood and trying to protect them from the realities of what the world is and what life is. And all the best children's entertainment or art does that. It allows, it's like, it's what Pixar does so well. It's what Peter Pan does so well. It's one thing for the kids, and then the kids will turn to their parents and kind of go, "Why are you sobbing, Daddy?" And you're kind of going, "Well, because I'm incredibly moved." And they go, "But it's a story about a cat bus." And you go, "I know, but it's about everything." It's, you know, I think trying to and the worst kind of children's entertainment is the stuff that talks down to children. Mm-hmm. And underestimates them. And yeah, and I hope we haven't done that in any way.
Mm. It's quite a responsibility in some ways. This is going to be, and has been already, and is going to be more so, many kids' first theatre experience.
Yeah.
And so I suppose you got that. You're going to make or break future theatre audiences. So, and it made me think, was there a stage production you saw as a kid that made you think that stage was something wonderful and magical and beautiful?
I think it happened a bit later for me, because I don't come from a family that's kind of was a particularly theatre going family. It was on a school theatre trip, and I must have been 16 or something, or maybe a bit younger, 15. And we went to see A View from a Bridge in the West End, which we were studying in English, I think. And it was Bernard Hill, you know, captain of the Titanic and star of Lord of the Rings. And he was playing Eddie Carbone, the main guy in View from a Bridge. And I was really taken with it as a kind of teenage kid from Sussex, kind of trying to connect with this middle-aged Stevie Dorr from New York in this Arthur Miller play. Kind of, but I think just the liveness of the storytelling really, really spoke to me, and it really made me. I can't remember who it is. There's a playwright who talks about theatre being an empathy engine, an empathy machine. Mm-hmm. It kind of teaches you to know how to feel. It breaks your heart safely, that sort of thing. And film does that too. TV does that too. But nothing's quite so direct, I think, as live theatre for making audiences experience feelings they wouldn't otherwise feel. And so the thought that that Totoro could be a defining or early theatre memory for so many people, I think I'm allowed to feel a bit proud of that. I think it's not a bad one.
No, absolutely. And judging from your Instagram, you probably have seen the play more than most people, maybe the most of any person.
Yeah.
You tried to sit in as many different sort of aspects on the stage as possible. So watching it through its initial production so many times, what did you learn about how the play was working, how it was working on the audience and everything in between?
Yeah, I think what they say about theatre, you know, it being different every night is very true. Some nights you get gasps when you see Totoro for the first time. Sometimes you get spontaneous applause. Sometimes you get, you know, awed silence. So it was never the same twice. I think when children in the audience were laughing and then adults kind of joined in the laughter in delight at the kids' delight, it was that sort of feedback, is a good vibes feedback loop, where, you know, you can feel it ripple through the audience. And that's kind of magical. It changed over its run as the cast kind of, not that it got better or it got worse, it just changed as the cast kind of found different things in the characters. with film, it's always the same performance. I've seen as many Maze and Satskis on stage as I've seen it on stage. I think there's another old maxim, which is if you write one novel and it's read by 1,000 people, you've written 1,000 novels. There's something about theatre where, you can kind of, there's one Totoro, there's one Mei, there's one Tatsuo, there's one Kanta, but also there are thousands of them, because not only is it multiplied by the number of people in the audience, it's multiplied by how many performances there are as well. And that's great. I love that. I mean, that's why I love live theatre so much, is that it's just ever so subtly different every time. It also gave me an opportunity to when you're adapting something, a lot of the time there might be things. It's always difficult adapting something that's so loved, because if it's flawless, if it's perfect, what would you change? But there was always one thing in Totoro that bothered me, that I was able to change, which is motorbike guy, the guy on the motorbike in the second half. When Satsuki's there saying, May's missing, have you seen a little girl? He says, no, good luck, bye. And he just drives off. And that always kind of went, what? That's dreadful. What a prick. So I managed to rewrite Motorbike Guy to be a bit more friendly and to kind of give her a lift back to the village, at least. But, yeah.
And that's the mark you've made.
Yeah, that's my contribution.
Yeah. Oh, Tom, this has been really wonderful chatting. What have you got coming up next? Is there anything you can tell us that we can look out for more of your writing? Are you going back into the world of physics?
I'm currently developing, I've got a couple of TV series that are in development at the moment, one of which is a bit further along than the other. I've got a couple of screenplays. I think I've got 3 screenplays on the go. I think COVID pushed me, you know, when theatre was, all the theatres were closed and no one was commissioning, but TV and film was still going, it's kind of moved my career in that direction for now. So I've got my first film in pre-production, which hopefully will shoot at the end of the year. But yeah, so I honestly, a bit of a break from theatre wouldn't hurt, though, because I don't know how I top Totoro. I don't know how I do better than the Barbican stage, the Royal Shakespeare Company, working with Studio Ghibli, Totoro, working with Phelim and Basil, and the cast that we've got, and working with the Jim Henson Company. It's like, I don't like anything else. What can possibly live up to that experience? So I'll take a little break from theatre for a while, I think.
Well, yes, we'll keep an eye out for all those projects as they come into view. But there is one last question we like to ask all our guests. And I wonder if this is actually perfectly suited for you, given what you said earlier about how you like filmographies and bodies of work, because that's how this podcast started. I was a big Ghibli nerd. Jake hadn't seen any of them. And I said, oh, you've got to see it, because the Studio Ghibli filmography is amazing in terms of how varied it is, but how high quality it is, how the worldview that is built across the films. And since we then watched all of Ghibli's films, we then looked to other filmmakers who had similar bodies of work that had a unique vision of the world or a distinctive vision. So we did Satoshi Kon, we branched out of Japanese animation to cover Henry Selick and Cartoon Saloon, world animators. So we like to ask our guests if there is a single filmmaker, or in your case, if there's a playwright or a dramatist that we should look to, who has a body of work that we should look through play by play or film by film in a similar way to Ghibli, who should it be?
Oh gosh, I mean, it's always it's a funny question, because you get asked as a writer a lot, who's your favorite writer? And sometimes you say, oh, it's Arthur Miller or it's Tennessee Williams, but there are also, they've written stuff that's not good as well as the stuff that's really great. But in terms of filmmakers, I really got into, when I was researching Totoro, I really got into watching all the Yasujirō Ozu films, particularly his later films, the ones, the six he made in colour are just absolutely gorgeous. And I was watching them because a lot of them are set in Tokyo in the 50s, and that's the world that Satsuki and May was coming from. And I just devoured them. And now I'm a Yasujirō Ozu fan. So work your way through him next, please.
I mean, he has like 50 films before the advent of sound cinema, doesn't he?
Yeah. He's got a whole silent stuff as well. He's got all his silent films, all his black and white films, and then he's got his colour films as well.
If you recommended one starting point, what would it be?
Oh, well, from Ozu. Well, you've got to start with Tokyo Story, I think, because that's the most famous one. But my personal favourite is Floating Weeds. He made it twice, once in silence and once in silent cinema, and one in colour. And the colour one is available on YouTube. I think it's just the most gorgeous film.
Oh, Tom Morton Smith, thank you so much for chatting with me. It's been such a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thank you to Tom Morton Smith for joining us on the podcast to talk all things Totoro and so much more, including recommending probably the biggest filmography we've been recommended yet on the podcast, Yasujirō Ozu. Jake, have you delved much into Ozu's filmography over the years?
I've watched a handful. You know, I've watched a lot of the big hitters, but there's so many of them that I feel like, you know, it's something like Desmond in Lost, where he has read all of Charles Dickens' books except one, and he likes to be reassured that there's always one more that he can read in a dire circumstance. And I feel like he's the kind of filmmaker where I need to apply that philosophy, gradually work through it over the course of a lifetime, but always have one more out there that I can watch.
Yeah, I've watched all Ozu's films apart from 33 of them, and I'm saving them for a rainy year. But also thanks to Bethany of the Royal Shakespeare Company for helping us set up that interview, that long-awaited interview. I'm so glad we were able to do that. I'm really excited to see what Tom has cooking away in development. I'd read about a project that he's working on with a filmmaker called Juan Carlos Medina, a horror filmmaker on a horror film. Juan Carlos Medina made a film a few years ago called The Limehouse Golem, which I thought was really terrific, as well as the Spanish-language horror film that was called Insensible or Painless. I'd recommend checking that out. So that I can't wait to see what that looks like, if that finally does see the light of day.
Yeah, that would be really, really good. I mean, this guy, he shifts around, doesn't he? I don't think anyone's thinking, oh yeah, the guy from the Totoro show is going to be doing a horror film next, but he's proven he can do it. But that is it for this episode. But if you want to hear more from us, we are, of course, always having conversations over on our Patreon exclusive podcast, The Library Cafe, which is where we break out of the chains of Studio Ghibli and Japanese animation to talk about whatever we like, really. And so in recent episodes, we delved into some comics we've been reading. So, Michael, you've been reading Ace Adora. I've been going back and rereading Tintin, and I think on the next episode, or whenever you're hearing this, it might have already come out, you're going to be telling me all about The Sandman, which is something I have not read, but something I have watched. And you're going to fill me in on everything I need to know about that show now that I've finished watching it.
Absolutely. We also have some other things going on in our lives. We've just unveiled our next book project that's coming out sort of between August and September. I think just on the threshold of September, which is The World of Studio Ghibli, which is our unofficial guide for younger readers to the themes and topics and craft behind the films of Studio Ghibli. It's been really fun putting that together after doing our 40,000 word kind of nerdy guides to then do something a bit more slim and illustration led, and working with Lucy Zhang, who's an Australian or Australia based illustrator. Oh god, it was such a dream to work on. Can't wait for that to come out.
Yeah, such a different practice as well, because you've really got to focus in on what you want to say and make that so accessible in the language. It's a totally different exercise for us, but so exciting to do. And actually, yeah, maybe that's a library cafe down the line, is how we actually write these things too. We should do that.
Well, that's a conversation for another day. Listeners, thank you for joining us. If you want to catch up with us in real time on social media, we're on Twitter at Ghibliotech. We're on Instagram, ghibliotech.pod. And you can follow us personally. Jake's on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
And Michael's there at Michael J. Leader.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShiel, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.